That evening, the minister gives a press conference to announce further exceptional liquidity assistance, that is to say money, for Royal Irish Bank. On the TV screen, he has regained his air of command, though he grips the lectern with both hands as if anticipating the torrent of fury that will come back at him. Sitting on the dais behind him, I spot the little sallow man staring at the minister as before, like some horror movie psychic demonstrating mind control.
"I don't get it," Kevin says.
"You're not the only one. Since the news came out, the zombies have been beating a drum by the unfinished HQ with motorists honking their horns in solidarity. Not long after the announcement, we discover the reason for the minister's clandestine visit the previous week. He has commissioned BOT to write a special report on Royal Irish Bank.
Essentially, they are worried that more recapitalization will be needed," Jürgen says. "A lot of taxpayers' money has been put into the bank. Now they are getting nervous that the bank's executives have misrepresented its return to health."
"Fucking right," Ish says. "Talk about makeup on a corpse." "They don't have advisors already?" I ask.
"Up until last week, they were being advised by Gerson Clay," Jürgen says. "However, as you are aware, Gerson have gone bust."
He pauses to allow himself a brief moment of gloating.
"I need hardly to tell you that this is a highly prestigious commission."
"Good job, Claude," Ish ruffles my hair.
"Is it going to be a lot of work?"
Kevin says. "Most of the work will be deciding how much we can get away with charging them," Ish says. "Poor old minister, he hasn't got a clue. If we told him to buy a really big mattress and stuff all the country's money in it, he'd go and do it."
"We will not be advising the government to put the country's money in a mattress," Jürgen says. "Rachel is keen that we find a positive angle, a way forward which will produce the most favourable outcomes for the major players."
News of the government commission, as well as our rival Gerson Clay's demise, buoys the whole office. I have my own reasons to be glad. Royal Irish was the centre of the great Ponzi scheme that was Ireland's property market, with one hand doling out money to the developers who built the apartments, housing estates and mansions, and the other doling it out to the people who wanted to live there, neglecting at every point to establish whether anyone was in a position to pay it back. This report, directed right into the heart of the national folly, will surely give Paul what he needs to root his novel. When the writer arrives at the office the next morning, however, he is not alone. A man is with him, a great hulking creature, almost 7 foot tall, with a sloping forehead and brawny knotted forearms that extend from an ill-fitting nylon shirt. Paul introduces him as Igor Struma, poet, professor of contemporary art, and member of the celebrated Vladivostok Circle.
"He's going to be helping me with the more conceptual stuff," Paul explains.
What exactly this means, I am not sure, but for the rest of the day, instead of observing me and my colleagues, the two of them spend their time muttering in secluded corners or slinking around the office, making inscrutable gestures, knocking on walls, poking at ceiling tiles, tracing with their fingers mysterious vectors from the floor behind computers up to the power supply.
"I have a bad feeling about this, Igor.
One cannot say what a poet ought to look like, of course, any more than one can say what a murderer ought to look like, but he definitely looks more like a murderer than a poet. He smells bad in several different ways at once, like curdled milk in a public lavatory, and when I type his name into the search engine, a red virus warning sign flashes up immediately on the screen, and a moment later a member of the IT team bursts into the office demanding to know what I've done."
The others do not seem to share my reservations. Jürgen, on the contrary, is positively ecstatic.
"Two famous writers! We have almost enough to start the salon!"
"But what is he doing here? Has anyone checked his credentials?"
"Paul asked him to help out with the book," Ish says. "You said yourself he was having a few problems. This is a good sign. You don't want him to pull the plug on the whole thing, do you?"
"Of course not. I'm just confused. If Paul is writing a book about me and my work here, why is he spending all this time with some poet?"
This is the artistic process,
Jürgen says with a shrug.
Who are we to question it?
I do not want to obstruct the artistic process, but when I see Igor under Paul's supervision making a gun shape with his thumb and finger and boring an imaginary hole into the wall, it is hard not to think the novel is being dismantled before my very eyes. Later that day, Paul invites me to the Ark for lunch, with his helpmeet nowhere to be seen.
I thought I should fill you in a little on Igor's role,
he says as the waitress guides us to a table.
You're probably wondering what he's doing here. I'm writing the book, you're the subject, what am I doing bringing a third party into it?
I make a stock gesture of innocence, as if the thought had never crossed my mind.
The fact is that while the romantic images of the writer working away in solitude, it's often more of a collaborative activity. Every writer has his strengths and weaknesses. It's quite common to draft in a colleague to help you out with elements you're less sure about.
I have heard about such practices in other art forms, but I confess I had not encountered it in literature before.
It's kind of a trade secret,
Paul says. Can you give me an example?
An example? Well, I suppose the most famous partnership would be J.R.R. Tolkien and Ian Fleming.
Really?
Oh, yes.
When Tolkien was putting the Lord of the Rings together, he was great at working out, you know, the ancestral backgrounds of the elves and so forth, but in terms of plot, he was hopeless. So he brought in someone who did know about plot, his old friend Ian Fleming, creator of James Bond.
The whole magic ring thing was Fleming's idea. In the original version, Tolkien was just going to have the hobbits and the elves reciting poems to each other.
I didn't know that, I say.
Similarly, Tolstoy, when he was writing War and Peace, found the peace parts no problem, but he really got stuck when it came to war. So he got in touch with an up-and-coming young naval officer called Winston Churchill.
Winston Churchill co-wrote War and Peace?
Just little bits here and there. Details, like I say, writers generally prefer not to talk about it.
And what is Igor's specialism?
Places. He's a master. Big places, small places, indoors, outdoors. He can do mountain ranges and lakes. He could write a paragraph about a broom cupboard that would have you bawling your eyes out. I suppose you could say he has an intuitive grasp of structure.
Which you feel has evaded you in the bank, I say.
Exactly. It's an unfamiliar environment. To be frank, not one that readily yields up its inner poetry.
That's true, I concede.
So I thought, okay, time to call in the expert. Given that I have this incredible access, which I am so, so grateful for,
I might as well take advantage of it. So Igor is going to be concentrating on the location details. The character stuff, plot, all that will still be me.
This does make sense. And you have known Professor Strohmayr for long?
That man taught me everything I know,
he says simply. Oh, I say, struggling to conceal my surprise, perhaps I have misjudged him. At that moment, the door opens. Paul waves and Igor lumbers, creaking towards us. He takes off his ancient rainmack, releasing a cloud of pungent inner odours, and gives the waitress his order with a dry, smacking mouth. He stares after her as she leaves, like a cat watching a pigeon.
So I was just telling Claude something about the collaborative process,
Paul says.
There is nothing wrong with collaborating,
Igor says rather confrontationally.
I mean in the book. You're going to help me out with the book?
Huh? Igor says.
The book?
Paul repeats.
Set in the bank, the tale of the everyman?
Oh, yes, yes, Igor says. Everyman, James Joyce, real life.
His bloodshot eyes swivel over to me.
You are the Frenchman, he says. Paris!
That's right, I say uncomfortably. Igor stares at me without speaking, his head weaving ever so slightly from side to side.
Lately I have watched excellent film about Paris, he says. In this film, three horny guys are going there and diddle many French prostitutes. Title of film is Ass Menagerie 2 French Connection. Have you seen?
No, I don't think so.
Is sequel to first Ass Menagerie.
He thinks about this, then adds,
"Vos story is very similar."
He retreats into a prolonged, cacophonous cough, a sound like shoveling coal.
"So Uyghur was wondering whether he might be able to see some floor plans of the bank," Paul says.
"Floor plans?" I say, surprised.
"To help him with the descriptive passages,"
Paul says. I glance over at Igor. He glares back at me with his basilisk eyes. I don't know what to say. Then, to my relief, the waitress comes along with his coffee, and he is distracted once again by her departing posterior.
"Very nice,"
he comments, and then asks Paul a question I don't quite catch, but which sounds something like,
"Have we got a file on her?"
Paul clears his throat in a way that might or might not be artificial, then says,
"So maybe I should explain a little more about Igor's process."
"I am sorry," Igor cuts in. "I must move seats. I cannot look at this fucking painting any longer."
With much clattering, he rises and drags his chair to the opposite side of the table so that his back is to the offending artwork. Simulacrum 18, I read from the label. "Our friend Ariadne Acheiropoietos again."
"So the way Igor likes to work," Paul persists.
"Oh, Jesus Christ, this one is even worse,"
Igor says, discovering he has moved seats only to find himself staring directly at Simulacrum 33.
"Is everything all right?" the waitress asks, hurrying over.
"He's just having a strong reaction to the art," Paul explains.
"I feel like I have fingers in my brain,"
Igor laments, rubbing his eyes.
"Oh," the waitress says.
"Well, let me know if you need anything."
She beats a retreat to the kitchen.
"So about these floor plans,"
Paul says.
But Igor has turned his gaze to me again. "What does this mean, this simulacrum?"
he demands.
"Is he serious? Didn't Paul say he was a professor of contemporary art? Or is he trying to catch me out?"
"It is a term from philosophy," I say reluctantly. "It means a bad copy or false image of something."
"Why are they covering the wall with fucking simulacrums in this place where people are trying to eat?"
The reptilian stare bores into me again.
"Huh?"
I stammer.
"Well, I imagine the artist is making some comment about fakes and counterfeits. Maybe by calling her painting simulacrum, she is pointing to some much bigger falseness in the world around us. Art is the lie that shows us the truth. Didn't someone say this?
Though I am sure you know more about it than I do." For a moment, I think I have satisfied him. Slowly, he sits down his cup and appears lost in contemplation. Then he leans over the table.
"Are you calling me a liar?"
he says in a low, guttural voice. And I see he has curled his fingers into a fist. Back at the bank, the situation only gets worse.
"He keeps poking at the ceiling," Gary McCrum complains. "Prodding at it with some sort of rod right over my head."
Joe Peston storms over.
"That fucking Russian of yours unplugged me terminal."
"He's researching a novel," I tell them both. Computers are interfered with, files misplaced. Kimberly approaches me in a state of disquiet to report that she sat down at her computer only to find Igor under her desk, apparently sniffing her seat.
"He is examining the structure," I say, but the truth is I have no idea what he is doing.
As for Paul, he barely speaks to me. He is too busy lifting furniture, pulling up floor tiles, taking paintings from the walls, and staring at the blank, pale spaces that are revealed. When I approach him, he snaps at me or nods without listening. Whatever has eluded him about BOT until now, Igor's appearance hasn't helped him. In the short time he has been here, he has aged visibly.
"It's not your fault," he says.
It's the next morning. We are in the canteen with the door closed, eating cereal bars. I feel strange to be hiding from our own narrator.
It's what Jürgen said, the artistic process. Writing a book is hard, that's all.
Maybe a bank isn't the right setting for a novel.
Well, he's got to make it the right setting, hasn't he? He says. That's his job, not yours.
I keep thinking he should have written about Howie. Cocaine, hookers, multi-million dollar trades.
He didn't want that, Claude. He wanted it in every man.
It could be that he has not found the right one.
You're crazy, Ish exclaims. You're a brilliant everyman.
You think so?
Definitely, she nods. I've been watching you, Claude, and you're doing a great job.
She squeezes my hand in hers.
Just be yourself, she says. Anyone would want to read a book about you.
I am touched by her words, but it is increasingly clear that my non-life in Dublin has defeated Paul's powers of representation, that there is simply not enough here for his art to gain a foothold. And when I emerge from the canteen, the final blow descends. Liam English, the head of the department, calls me over.
Look at this, he says.
On the other side of the room, Igor is holding the water cooler steady while Paul balances on top of it, unscrewing the vent over the air conditioning, apparently with the intention of inserting some kind of camera into the interior. I try to make light of it, remarking on the incredible concentration that artists bring to bear on things that we take for granted, such as air vents.
Wrap it up, Liam English says.
I wait until Igor is not around, then approach Paul at the desk he has commandeered. He is scribbling in the red notebook, which he now shuts and covers with his hand.
Yes, he says.
Lunchtime, I say. He casts about him, looking for an excuse to refuse me, but he can't find one and reluctantly rises from the desk. I don't know how significant it is that the very same waitress seats us at the very same table where we had our first conversation. It mightn't necessarily mean that we have come full circle, yet how changed he is from that ebullient, garrulous figure who stepped into my life that day. Now he barely speaks. When our food comes, he merely picks at it.
You are not happy? I say.
What?
You are not happy with this project?
I'm perfectly happy,
he says.
I'm deliriously happy.
You have not said a word to me all day.
Maybe I just don't feel like talking.
I don't believe that is why.
Oh, you can read my mind now.
It's obvious things are not working.
Paul puts his hands on top of his head and lets out a long, slow, whistling sound.
I told you there is a structural issue. We'll figure it out if you'll just get off my case.
My boss wants you to finish your research. This at least produces a reaction. He bangs his palms on the table.
What? He says it's becoming disruptive. That's crazy!
Paul protests.
Who are we disrupting?
Everyone, I say with a trace of sadistic pleasure, then regret it. He is beyond crestfallen. He looks utterly sick. Maybe I can talk to him, win you an extra day or two, I say, but only you, Igor, must go.
Okay.
He mutters.
Thanks.
I watch him for a moment, his thoughts visibly in disarray.
What happened?
I ask.
Something in him seems to give. He sets down his fork, gazes back at me starkly.
There's nothing there, Claude,
he says.
I can't find anything there.
Now it is my turn to feel sick.
I knew it wouldn't work.
He reflects.
Deep down, I knew it.
There must be something we can do, I say. Some way to salvage it.
I don't see what if your boss is kicking me out.
He says.
There must be something.
He sighs, puts his head in his hands. He stays like that for a long time, then he lifts his head again.
Unless,
he says.
Unless what? Unless...
He stares at me, studying my face as if trying to read something there.
Unless we change the angle,
he says at last. Change it?
Right now I'm seeing two very serious problems with the book. The first is that nothing happens. There's no story there. In the past, the novel didn't always need a story. You could just make it about a day in somebody's life, but that was when life meant people, movement, activity. You guys in front of your screens all day long, selling each other little bits of debt, it's a whole different order of nothing. I know there's a big story behind it, I know the bank is expanding and growing and so on, but I can't see any of that. It's like a hurricane, you know? It's this incredibly powerful entity storming all over the world, leveling everything in its path, but at the eye of it, where you are, it's just a void. Dead space.
I nod bleakly. This does not seem an unreasonable assessment.
And obviously that affects our everyman, he says. Which is problem two. Readers like to feel a connection with the characters they're reading about. Visit a book club, that's all they talk about. I love Pip, I adore Daisy, Yossarian is so funny, we all hated Snowball. But with you, there's just not enough showing up on the page.
Huh? I say.
I know there's more to you than some anonymous salaryman, but from the reader's perspective, it's not so clear. Unless they see some evidence to the contrary, my fear is they'll see a banker and immediately think the worst.
Yes, I say, seething with embarrassment.
Look,
he says,
it's not irremediable. We just need to give your character more agency. We need to get him doing something.
Like what?
Something dramatic,
he says. He looks down at his coffee, stirs it, but doesn't drink.
Everybody,
he says slowly.
Even the guy with the most boring job in the world at some point finds himself in a situation where he has to make a choice. A choice between good and bad. That moment, when the clock strikes 13, when everything else drops away, that's where we need to put you.
Is it me, or as he says this, does the air seem to tauten, to take on some tremulous energy? A cloud's shadow rolls over the plaza. The dark-haired waitress stops at the window with her hands on her hips as the pigeons take flight.
For example,
he says. He strokes his chin.
Okay, how about this? Rather than the everyman just working in the bank, instead we have him rob the bank.
Rob the bank? I repeat.
That's right,
Paul says, nodding. Rob it, I say again, in case I have misheard.
Yes, rob it,
Paul says. This is Igor's idea?
No, it's my idea. You can see where I'm coming from, right? It spices things up, gives the story momentum, as well as making your character a bit more attractive. Now you're an outlaw, sticking it to the man.
Yes, yes, I understand that. I dab my mouth with my napkin in case my expression gives me away. But robbing a bank, is this really something that our everyman would do?
Why wouldn't he?
Paul returns.
Who hasn't thought about robbing a bank?
Nobody actually does it, I say. It just doesn't seem realistic.
It's not like I'm saying we'd send him back in time,
Paul says testily.
He's not breaking the laws of physics or anything.
Nevertheless, it takes us far away from the authentic picture of modern life you wanted to create originally, I point out. In fact, it turns the story into exactly the kind of cliché you told me you wanted to escape. I am not trying to be negative, I say, seeing his face darken, only I don't understand what kind of motivation our everyman can have to do something as non-universal as rob a bank.
Well, he'll have a motivation,
he says.
I'm going to give him a motivation if you just let me finish.
I'm sorry, please continue. Paul begins to speak and then stops, staring furiously into his coffee cup. Because already the everyman is paid very well for work that is quite legal, I clarify. So it is difficult to imagine what will make him do something very risky like this.
What if he wants something his money can't buy?
Paul says. He wants to rob the bank to get something money can't buy? Paul swears under his breath.
Okay, how about he falls in love?
In love?
Yeah, with a waitress. That girl there, for instance.
We both turn to look. The dark-haired waitress is on the other side of the cafe, placing dirty crockery onto a tray. Her long ebony tresses are tied up in a bun, from which a ballpoint pen pokes.
See, we need to be making better use of the resources we have. Fictionally speaking, someone like her is pure gold. She's sultry, she's exotic, she's a struggling artist. A woman like that, as soon as she appears, the story's bumped up a couple of gears.
She's an artist?
Well, yeah.
He stares at me as if I am an imbecile, then points around the room at the various simulacra.
Those are hers? I look over at the waitress again, then back at him. She's Ariadne Akeropoitos?
How do you know?
Because I asked her.
Oh. I sit back dizzily.
See, it's a good twist, isn't it?
I am thinking of the many uncomplimentary things my colleagues and I have said about her paintings while she was standing right beside us.
So our lonely, bored, overpaid banker runs up against this beautiful but impoverished painter.
He goes on, warming to his new theme.
He finds they have something or other in common. It doesn't matter what it is, French philosophy say. Next thing he knows, he's fallen head over heels in love with her. He's breaking out of his sterile world of numbers, experiencing feelings he hasn't had in years. But how's he going to win her heart?
I find I am gripped in spite of myself. How?
Paul spreads his hands summatively. By robbing the bank!
The intrigue dies away again. I am not sure I see the connection.
You don't think robbing a bank will get her attention?
There must be easier ways to do it, I say. What about their shared interest in French philosophy? Paul rolls his eyes heavily.
Jesus, Claude, a woman like that? Every dude who comes in here is going to be hitting on her. He needs to bring out the big guns. So how about this? He finds out that her father's going to die unless he gets a vital operation, but it's an extremely expensive operation, so expensive that even the banker doesn't have enough money to pay for it. So he robs the bank. I know it sounds unrealistic on the face of it,
he continues before I can object,
but in terms of showing his inner life, it's actually more realistic. Do you see what I mean? She inspires him. She's everything he's not. She believes in things, in art, in love, in life. He looks at her and he sees a chance to begin again.
He's gazing across the room at the waitress, his cheeks flushed as if it is he, in fact, who's being brought back to life.
From talking to her. Because she's Greek, so we can put in all the stuff about the financial crisis, what it's done to her home and her family. The everyman begins to become aware of all the injustice he's part of. He's not going to take it anymore. He'd rather rob the bank and risk going to prison than see the woman he loves suffer another minute. Suddenly we've got a hero we can get behind.
He falls silent, poring happily over the empty space of the cafe as if seeing the story enact itself in front of his eyes, until at last I clear my throat. He looks up, startled, then waves his hand.
Well, anyway, those are just the broad strokes,
he says.
The real question.
His voice lowers. Resting his elbows on the table, he clasps his hands tightly together, as if warding something away.
Is how he robs the bank.
He looks at me expectantly. How? I repeat.
If you were in that position where you wanted to pay for an operation for Ariadne's dying father, what would you do?
Probably I would speak to the head of department about an advance on my bonus. Paul exhales sharply.
No, if you were robbing the bank, Claude.
I give the question some thought.
I don't know.
You don't know?
If I can be honest, since he decided to rob the bank, I have felt more and more estranged from our everyman.
Claude.
With a murderous expression, Paul lifts his arms above his head like an orchestra conductor at the thunderous apex of some violent symphony. Then he lowers them again and slumps back in his chair, and he says, in a wan, tired voice,
I'm not going to lie to you. I need this. It's been a long time since Clown. I need this book, and this book needs a story, and right now it doesn't have one.
I blink back at him. I want to help, but his story no longer makes sense to me.
It doesn't have to be your character, even,
Paul says with a touch of desperation.
Say there's a very wicked banker in there. That guy, what's his name, the arsehole from the bar. He wants to rob the bank. What does he do?
He is pale now, and his voice has a dry, prickly quality like a fabric charged with static electricity.
I suppose what I'm asking you is, where's the safe in this place?
The safe?
The safe.
His eyes are locked on mine. His fingertips bounce up and down on the tabletop. Well, there is no safe, I say.
What?
He puts his hand to his ear as if he were a long way away. There is no safe, I repeat louder.
There's no safe?
No, I say. Paul stares at me for a long moment. Then he glances over his shoulder to the table by the window where Jürgen has just sat down with one of the senior managers.
Oh, I get it.
He smiles, giving me a wink.
Classified information. Okay, put it this way then. Where isn't the safe?
This ontological riddle throws me. I contemplate it for a long time before replying slowly.
Well, I suppose it isn't everywhere.
Paul stops smiling and kneads his brow.
Look, when I ask where isn't the safe, I mean where is the safe. When you say there is no safe, what is it exactly that you mean?
I mean there is no safe, I say. He exhales a long, thin breath, his body at the same time seeming to drift a little to the side.
So where, he says softly, do you keep the money?
There is no money, I say.
There is no money,
Paul repeats, nodding, and then,
what kind of a bank has no money?
A merchant or investment bank, I say. Paul goes very quiet. He lifts his coffee cup to his mouth, but his hand is trembling so hard that he lowers it again without it reaching his lips.
Oh,
he says. You must remember that, unlike a high street bank, an investment bank does not take deposits from its customers. Instead, we fund our operations primarily with short-term or even overnight borrowings.
Right,
Paul whispers. Of course, we don't like to talk about this because it means that we're a lot less secure than we pretend. In fact, we're all just 24 hours away from a funding crisis. This is investment banking's dirty little secret. Paul's laughter is low and hoarse, as if he had a rope around his neck.
So now the question we have to ask ourselves is, given that it's an investment bank with no money on the premises, how is he going to rob it?
He looks at me with eyes half dazed and half desperate.
That's the question we have to ask, isn't it?
I chew on my knuckles thoughtfully. I fear it will be difficult for our everyman, I say.
It will.
Very difficult.
Right,
Paul says. For a long moment he doesn't say anything else or even look at me. He merely sits in his chair twitching. But there are other ways for you to spice up the story, I say, realizing that I have made him even more discouraged than he was already. For example, maybe there is a fire in Transaction House and I am the Bank of Torabundo fire warden, so I must make sure everyone escapes.
That's a good idea.
Paul agrees, rising unsteadily to his feet.
A
Very good idea.
Or we could keep the love story with the waitress and the French philosophy, but leave out the robbery.
Yes, Bull says. That's worth looking at.
And meanwhile, my character is dealing with the ongoing crisis in the Eurozone. Nobody knows how much the currency will depreciate. It's a very tense situation.
Yes, there's certainly a lot to think about.
Paul interrupts in the oddly wispy voice into which he has lapsed. I have the strange impression there is less of him. As if over the course of the lunch, little pieces of him have been stolen away like twigs taken by birds as they build their nest, one by one by one.
Seems like I better get back to the drawing board. Tell you what, I'm going to take the rest of the afternoon off to think about these suggestions of yours.
Frankly, I think the book will be much better this way, I say. The bank robbery idea was perhaps a little de trop, like we say in French.
It probably was,
he says.
I don't know what I was thinking. Well, see you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, I say.